guest this evening is Chris Pinto, and we're talking about a new DVD, and he is actually was the producer of this, or at least he wrote the script. He put it together, he directed it, along with David Bay. And those of you who don't know David Bay has a ministry called Cutting Edge. It's on the Internet. He does an excellent job, and he does, certainly on the printed page, what we try to do on the radio, and that is try to introduce people into the fact that there really are secret societies. Now, Chris has put together this excellent DVD. It's called The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning. The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, Part 1, The New Atlantis. And this idea, why don't you repeat again this idea of what is this New Atlantis? Where did this idea come from? Because, you know, most people have heard of Lost Atlantis, but the New Atlantis?
Yeah, the idea of the New Atlantis dates back to Sir Francis Bacon in the 16th and 17th century. Really, the 17th is when he finished. Well, he didn't really finish it, but when he was writing the New Atlantis, and then it was published posthumously after his death by friends of his.
And he died what, about 1626 somewhere there?
1626, yeah.
Right. Okay.
And so the New Atlantis was published shortly thereafter. And is considered by, men like Masonic writers like Manly P. Hall, who claims that this is kind of the blueprint for all the secret societies. Masonry, Rosicrucianism, it would even extend into the Skull and Bone Society that was founded, I believe, in the 19th century. And that this is the underlying purpose of all of these societies that Manly Hall referred to as the Order of the Quest, collectively. And it doesn't matter which of them they are. They're all ultimately pursuing this utopian dream to build a single world order that will be like paradise on Earth. And in our documentary, we have a Baconian expert, a man named Peter Dawkins, who's studied Bacon for about 33 years, and he's the founder of an organization called the Francis Bacon Research Trust over in England. And he's actually affiliated with the chief Masonic, I guess with the pro grand master of British Freemasonry over in England. And this person, a guy named the Marquis de Northampton, who is affiliated with the royal family, is the acting head of British Freemasonry, and he supports the work of Peter Dawkins. And Dawkins not only is supported by Northampton, but also teaches at the Globe Theatre there in London, which is dedicated to the works of Shakespeare and so on. And, of course, one of the things that we get into in our documentary is the long-held belief that Sir Francis Bacon and his secret society are the real authors of the Shakespeare plays, primarily Bacon, but with some of his fellow artists and poets as well. And that the plays were developed, along with a number of other literary works, to transform the English language and to prepare English-speaking people to come and colonize the New World, so that they would have a language by which they could incorporate all of the ancient wisdom of the ancient world. And Bacon dedicated his whole life to importing all the Greek and the Roman and the ancient mystery writings and so on, so that they would be available to English-speaking people, which is, I believe, at least from the research that I've done, the reason why in our school system today, all of these ancient works, the writings of Homer and, the writings of Plato and the teachings of Aristotle and so on, and all the works of Shakespeare are generally required reading at some point in our education system. And it's something that was developed very specifically. It wasn't just an accident. Bacon knew very much what he was doing. Bacon coined the phrase, knowledge is power. And he believed that by empowering English-speaking people with knowledge, that they would advance. And he launched this movement that he called the Advancement of Learning, that they would advance and flourish in the New World and ultimately spread throughout the world and establish this utopian empire that would be, if you will, the New Atlantis. And the concept, of course, dates back to at least Plato, the concept that Atlantis had been this perfect system. And depending upon which writer you get hold of, like Manly Hall believed that Atlantis was a mighty empire that extended to the whole world, that it was this philosophic commonwealth. And he writes about this, and he writes about the dream of democracy and how democracy was the hidden concept within all the secret societies, and that they carried this idea of democracy one generation after another. And, of course, we know in the ancient world that the ancient kingdoms were ruled by kings and queens and monarchies and so on. And so the idea of democracy was, in reality, especially if you study the ancient world and through the Dark Ages, democracy was considered the enemy, of the monarchal system. And the idea of educating the common man was considered to be very dangerous, to give knowledge to the masses. Well, then if you gave them knowledge, then they might be enlightened, and then they might rise up, and they might gain an advantage over you. And so kings and queens and princes and so on didn't really want the common man educated. But Bacon, it would seem from what he did, recognized that this was essential to building his concept of paradise on earth. And this utopian concept of rebuilding paradise, as Bacon saw it, is essentially the plan for the New World Order. And that's what we try to point out in our documentary, that the New Atlantis, paradise on earth, that is the driving motivation behind secret societies and this New World Order plan.
And, of course, Francis Bacon was a Rosicrucian. Knights of the Rosy Cross. And, of course, this was then their idea, that Rosicrucians had been around several hundred years by the time Francis Bacon was living. But the Rosicrucians were simply carrying on the tradition of the Templars, who were carrying on the traditions of the ancient Magi. And then, of course, and you have to understand, of course, so much of Greek philosophy was based upon the writings of Pythagoras, who preceded Socrates, who preceded Plato, who preceded Aristotle, who preceded Alexander the Great, who set out to conquer the whole world. But it was all based upon the occult. Plato taught certain things, and what he wrote, why they were written in a way that there could be several interpretations of them. One, of course, for the common people like you and me, and then the other for the elite. So there always was buried within the teachings the secret message, and the secret message was really about this elite establishing this one world government. And Francis Bacon, dying in 1626, but it was his followers who came to America shortly thereafter, established the secret Rosicrucian cells here in America, and of course it began to corrupt and undermine the very Christian fabric of our society, because there was a tremendous antagonism towards Christianity, so that by 1740 America was a totally corrupt and debased society. And then came the first Great Awakening, with men like Jonathan Edwards and John Wesley, and suddenly there was a turning back to God, and out of that great revival, the first Great Awakening, the first Great Arrival, came this Christian intent upon creating a sovereign nation here. But at the very same time, and this is what most Christians and most Americans don't understand, there were these occult forces. The Rosicrucians were here too. So the Christians wanted to establish a Christian civilization, but the Rosicrucians wanted a new civilization as well, but they wanted to use that at some time in the future to bring the whole world together under the control of a ruling elite, and they wanted to establish what would be the new philosophical Atlantis. Would that be a fair statement, Chris?
Yeah, it certainly would be, and Bacon, as you pointed out, him being involved with the Rosicrucians, it's believed that the Rosicrucians, depending on which version of their history you read, you can trace them all. They go back several thousand years, possibly. Some people believe they began in Germany. Others, like Peter Dawkins, argue that they really began, the modern Rosicrucian movement began in England, but there doesn't seem to be a clear agreement. the concept, though, of Rosicrucianism, which we talk about, and you say something, just so people know in case they don't know, we interview Dr. Stan in the documentary, and he does a fabulous job. But one of the things that you say in the documentary is you're talking about Rosicrucianism, and then you say, you know, most people have no idea that this organization even exists. And I talk to people all the time, you know, who call our ministry and ask questions about our other work where we're talking about Freemasonry and the Illuminati or other secret societies. But most people are largely unaware of Rosicrucianism, and they are such an influential society and have been over the centuries. They've had a huge influence on Freemasonry, and especially, I think, the ecumenical movement that's at work in the world today, because the concept of the Rose and Cross, generally speaking, even though there's a number of interpretations, the one that seems to hit home the most is the idea that the Rose represents the ancient mystery system, while the Cross represents Christianity. And the combining or blending or infusing of these two, opposing forces, that is really what Rosicrucianism does.
And of course, I thought your pictures there of the Rosicrucian Temple in San Jose, California, that, for the people who would say this couldn't be true, and here you have the pictures of this Egyptian temple, much of it Egyptian lore, right in the very heart of San Jose, California. And there's probably very, very few people have any idea. Yes, this is Chris Pinto, and we're talking about the new DVD they put out, and that is The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, Part 1, The New Atlantis. And certainly he's talking about Francis Bacon, Sir Francis Bacon, probably a person who's not well known to the average American, and yet you find his influence everywhere in America today. Because Masonry, which Sir Francis Bacon really more or less formalized and organized, even though it wasn't officially chartered until 1717, but it was Francis Bacon's writings that were really the forerunners of modern-day Masonry. And modern-day Masonry is simply the present-day manifestations of the ancient mystery religions. And, of course, it contains the writings of the Illuminati, the writings of the Rosicrucians, of the Theosophists, and the ancient mystery religions. Until you understand, there has always been another dimension to the world, whether it be the ancient Magi, who went to Bethlehem in search of the Jesus child, but they were aware of the writings, the ancient writings, that Jesus would be born at that time. And so they followed the star to Bethlehem. There have been two forces in the world. One, the force of our Lord, and of course the other, the dark side. And this battle has gone on since the inception of time. It is being played out with amazing clarity on the stage of today's world, and the average person doesn't understand that everything going on has a spiritual connotation. But so much of it is really founded in what Chris talks about in this amazing video, which everybody who wants to understand what's going on today will want to see. And of course, the pictures were taken at Rosslyn Chapel. Now, most people had never heard of Rosslyn Chapel until Dan Brown wrote the Da Vinci Code. But, the byproduct of the book was it ends with the heroine and the villain are in Rosslyn Chapel. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about Rosslyn Chapel and why it is so important, what it represents?
Oh, certainly. Rosslyn is a fascinating place. We went there, of course, and shot some footage. We got permission to go inside the chapel and with our camera and set up a tripod and whatnot, and even interviewed, which we show, the director of the Rosslyn Chapel Trust, a guy named Stuart Beatty, a very nice man. But Rosslyn Chapel, as far as the founding of America is concerned, because that's really what we're talking about, and Sir Francis Bacon had this concept that America, he calls in his New Atlantis, his writing, the New Atlantis, he refers to America as Atlantis, that America, this lost continent, that it, not that it was, you know, going to become a new Atlantis, but it was the place where ancient Atlantis was. And this was an idea that was held by men like Dr. John Dee, the most learned men of that time, held this view that America was Atlantis. So the question comes about, well, where did they get this idea? Why America of all places? Why not some other island somewhere? One of the things that we track down is the pre-Columbian knowledge of the American continent, and that's what takes us to Rosslyn Chapel. Because in Rosslyn Chapel, there are certain types of vegetation. It's if you study Rosslyn and people who kind of follow the Da Vinci Code and whatnot, this information has become pretty commonplace. But still, there's a lot of people who aren't aware that inside Rosslyn Chapel are carved, for example, ears of corn, Indian maize, which were not indigenous to the European continent, but they were indigenous to the American continent.
And I think it's so important that people understand Rosslyn Chapel was completed in 1492.
Yeah. So they were building it for some 50-odd years prior to, you know, Columbus supposedly discovering America. And the question comes about, okay, how did the builders know to carve this Indian corn? Where did they get the idea of this Indian corn, unless it came to them somehow from the New World? And then there's other things. There's the aloe cactus plants, which are carved along the archways there.
And they're carved in stone. I mean, this is not something you do just overnight.
Right. And back then, as Stuart Beattie explains in the documentary, they would have gone through a long process. They would have had the original plant. They would have made drawings of it. They would have carved it into wood. All of these things would have been approved by the builders. And then they would have been carved in stone and then set in place there in the chapel. So they really took quite a bit of time. So they had to know what it was that they were carving and setting in place. And there's even a third plant that we show, a trefoil plant, which is a type of clover that one particular botanist believed was the, you know, the slam dunk in terms of proving.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess is Chris Pinto, and talking about, of course, Rosslyn Chapel over in Scotland, completed in 1492 and yet containing in it a vegetation, ears of corn, other things, depicting things that were present in the New World. And yet, of course, it was 1492 when Columbus set off to discover America. So long before Columbus ever came to America, the people who created this mysterious chapel, Rosslyn Chapel, which, of course, is immortalized in Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Codes, as this really a center of the world occult movement, and it really is, of course, that they knew so much about America long before it was discovered. And the question is, how? And Chris was saying that, well, one explanation is given is that the Templars had a fleet of ships which disappeared after Jacques de Molay was arrested on Friday the 13th, 1307, because, of course, it had been discovered that they were Luciferians, and they had found the secret of the ages, which, of course, was the fact that Lucifer indeed is God. But go ahead.
Well, I was saying there, you know, there's a number of theories about whether or not the Templars made it to the New World, and while some people think that's far-fetched, it's the evidence. I mean, for example, we point out that when Columbus went to the New World, Columbus was married to a woman whose family was apparently came from a long line of Knights Templar. And when Columbus sailed to America, he sailed with red crosses on a white background, which anybody, if you get online and you look up, you know, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, the ships that Columbus sailed with, all the paintings will show that, you know, the white background with a red cross. Well, of course, that's the symbol of the Knights Templar. And is this all just a big coincidence? And Buff Perry, who's a professional cipher that we interview in the documentary, he talks about Columbus getting hold of these Portolans and cartographs, which are types of charts and so on, and there's a lot of speculation, and of course there's evidence that Columbus himself, as Manly P. Hall believes, was a member of secret societies. And so there is speculation that the Templars probably did have some kind of access to the New World, whether they went there themselves or they knew others who went, and that they had handed this knowledge down from one generation to another. But to me, the real slam dunk on this whole thing is the research of Harvard professor Barry Fell, who uncovers along the northeast coastline all this evidence, you know, archaeological evidence, Roman coins. He's finding carvings. He's finding underground caves, all of these things that he writes about in his book, America B.C., that dates Europeans and people from the ancient world, from ancient Egypt and Carthage and Rome and so on, that had access to the New World. And the archaeological evidence is there that, yes, they did come to the New World, and there were a number of people who knew about this place. And so, as we say in the documentary, people knew about this. They knew that this land was here long before the time of Columbus. And Manly Hall's assertion in his book about the secret destiny of America is that the secret societies, they were the ones who knew about this land. And they believed that it was intended to be this launching pad for this new Atlantean dream that would lead mankind into a golden era. And so they kept it secret for centuries and centuries and centuries, waiting, you know, until it would be officially revealed or unveiled to the world. And this is the movement that we believe Sir Francis Bacon was a part of. And this is why he set his secret societies in motion with English literature, with Masonry, with Rosicrucianism, and was such a key player, along with guys like Dr. John Dee and most likely Queen Elizabeth, Sir Walter Raleigh, this whole group, sending people to the New World to colonize it, and especially to do so before it fell into the hands of Rome, and launch this new Atlantean empire from the American continent.
All right, well, let me just briefly read from Manly P. Hall, his book, The Secret Destiny of America, because, of course, what he says is so similar to what George W. Bush says. Here I'm writing, quoting from The Secret Destiny of America. World democracy was the secret dream of the great classic philosophers. Toward the accomplishment of this greatest of all human ends, they outlined programs of education, religion, and social conduct directed to the ultimate achievement of a practical and universal brotherhood. One of the most ancient of man's constructive ideas is the dream of universal democracy and a cooperation of all nations in a commonwealth of states. The mechanism for the accomplishment of this ideal was set in motion in the ancient temples of Greece, Egypt, and India. So brilliant was the plan, and so well was it administered that it has survived to our time. Now, here's Manly P. Hall, who is certainly the most brilliant of all Masonic philosophers. When he died, he was said by the Scottish Rite magazine to have been the greatest of all Masonic philosophers. He was himself a Satanist. He worshipped Lucifer. But here's what George Bush says. As the 20th century ended, and of course, this is a talk he gave the National Endowment for Democracy on November 6, 2003, and here's George Bush. As the 20th century ended, there are about 120 democracies in the world, and I can assure you more are on the way. We've witnessed the swiftest advance of freedom in the 2,500 years story of democracy. Historians in the future will offer their own explanations for why this happened. Yet we already know some of the reasons they will cite. It is no accident that the rise of so many democracies took place in a time when the world's most influential nation was itself a democracy. Well, of course, America is not a democracy, it's a republic, so why does, of course, President Bush keep referring to democracy? Democracy, democracy, democracy. And, of course, this was the plan of the ancient secret societies, the ancient religions. And you have one wonderful quotation in there from George Bush where you actually see him. What was that quotation, do you recall?
Well, it's in the opening of the documentary where we explain Manly Hall's teaching about, you know, Atlantis being this philosophic commonwealth, a democratic commonwealth that would spread democracy to all the world, and how this is something that Bacon was representing. And then we point out the Novus Ordo Seclorum, because Bacon called himself the herald of the new age. And then we say, could this have something to do with the new order of the ages that's on the back of the U.S. dollar bill? And then we show President Bush in his inaugural address in 2005 after he was reelected. And he says, quote, he says, when our founders declared a new order of the ages, he says they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled.
Would you mind repeating that? I think that is one of the most amazing statements. Could you repeat that for us, Chris?
Yeah, it was, when our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled.
And I think it's so important to understand that most of our founding fathers were not involved in this idea, you know, of creating this universal democracy, but a few of them were. In fact, one of the most famous quotations that we attribute Benjamin Franklin, and people have probably heard of it, you know, the longer I live, the more convinced I am of the fact that God rules in the affairs of men, and if a sparrow cannot fall without his knowledge, can a great empire be raised without his blessing? Well, you know, most of our founding fathers weren't interested in raising a great empire. They wanted a Christian country. That, of course, would offer freedom here in America. But there were those who, like Benjamin Franklin, was a Rosicrucian and a Mason and deeply involved in the whole occult world, who recognized that that we were creating an empire. And if you look at the emblem on the back of the dollar bill, the pyramid, capped by the all-seeing eye, and you go back and you get the story of the Great Seal of the United States, because that came from the back of the Great Seal of the United States, you'll find that there are three or four men on the original committee that created the Great Seal of the United States, which was hidden until 1935. And then when a brother, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, of course he was a 32nd degree Mason, put that on the back of the dollar bill to announce, of course, the final arrival as we move towards the establishment of this new Novo Ordo Seclorum. But Benjamin Franklin was one of the three or four people instrumental in creating that original emblem. And, of course, this is strongly occult. I mean, what's a pyramid have anything to do with America? And that all-seeing eye and the triangle, that is the symbol of the ancient mystery religions. So what's it doing on the back of the dollar bill? Unless you understand the Baconian dream, and, of course, the part that Sir Francis Bacon and Benjamin Franklin played in that, and the dream of a world empire, you can't understand anything going on today.
Yeah, as we point out in the two things I was gonna mention. We point out there's a Newfoundland stamp that when I saw it, I was, you know, my jaw hit the floor when I was doing the research. But there's a Newfoundland stamp that has Francis Bacon's picture on it, and it's like a 19 turn of the century stamp, and it. It says at the bottom, it says, Lord Bacon, the guiding spirit in the colonization scheme. And it's very interesting that at the turn of the century, there were those who had a very clear understanding that Bacon was behind this whole colonization scheme or concept. Even guys like Sir Walter Raleigh, who, you know, the lost colony at the Roanoke, and we talk, you know, more about that in the documentary, but Raleigh was a part of the whole Baconian circle. Prior to that, Bacon was influenced by a guy named Dr. John Dee that we talk about a pretty good bit, because Dee himself was very influential in the teachings and the advancement of knowledge and science and so on that has really been such an important driving force in the new world. It is what has enabled, and we should say while we're talking about this, Dr. Stan, that Francis Bacon is considered the father of modern science, of developing the modern scientific method that pulled men out of the Dark Ages view science and into the experimental method view that was picked up by guys like Sir Isaac Newton and John Locke and others, and even men like Benjamin Franklin, who would certainly have been influenced by Bacon's scientific method. And that's what Bacon really believed. In his New Atlantis, he's writing about this empire that has all of these wondrous scientific achievements. And he's writing about a lot of things. He's writing about experiments with animals. He's writing about sound studios where, you know, you develop different types of sounds. And you can just see like a modern recording studio in his writing here that he's setting down back in the 1600s. And he's writing about, you know, tall buildings and flying machines and hospitals and healthcare centers and all of these different things that have materialized through the 19th and 20th century in America. And, of course, people who read the New Atlantis are just fascinated, like Manly Hall was, and you wonder, how did he have this such a clear and in many ways very specific, because he's not just, you know, writing about some general stuff. He's writing about some very specific elements that are very specific to the New World and most of them have all come to pass.
Well, I think that people have to understand that there is another dimension that certain people can tap into. Now, you don't want to tap into it. This is what mediums and sorcerers and true magicians, not the stage magicians, but there really are people with supernatural power. There really are people who can channel all sorts of things. Ed Casey was a channel. Monday evening, we see a program on television about a medium. It's based upon a true story of a woman who was a medium who helped a district attorney catch the bad guys. But, of course, she was tapping into the very root of hell for this knowledge. So I suspect that Mason, as with so many of the people who are into the esoteric societies, you know, really channeled a great deal of their information. Have you thought of that?
Oh, certainly. And that's what we try to bring out in the documentary. Dr. John Dee, who was the foremost scientist prior to Bacon, certainly he was. Dee was famous for communicating with angelic powers that, you know, as Christians we would easily recognize as demons. And Sir Francis Bacon was in communication with the spirit realm. Clearly, and we even present a quote where it would seem Bacon was in touch with a spirit calling itself Pallas Athena, the ancient Greek goddess, but that his inspiration likewise came from the spirit realm. And that's part of the backbone and the heart of Rosicrucianism, is the Rosicrucians believed, as Ian Taylor explains in Secret Mysteries, that these spirits, and some of them they acknowledged were even demons, but that they had a lot of intelligence, they had a lot of knowledge. And that if you tap into them, they can give you knowledge. And incredibly enough, as you know, Dr. Stan, some of the great scientists of the 20th century, men like Thomas Edison or Chester Carlson, who developed the Xerox machine and so on, and others, have all admitted to practicing some form of, you know, altered consciousness where they're tapping into powers from the spirit realm that are giving them the inspiration for these great scientific ideas and advancements that they come up with.
And I think that's really so important for people to understand. Thomas Edison was a disciple of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. And Helena Petrovna Blavatsky was a Luciferian. If you haven't read, I wouldn't suggest you try to read her Secret Doctrine, but in Volume 2, and we quote from it extensively in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, she tells you that Lucifer is God, that Satan is this wonderful, wonderful angel, that most people think he's bad, but he's really very, very good. And until people begin to grasp how this all fits together, they are totally incapable of understanding so much of what's going on today. You can watch the Discovery Channel and the History Channel and all the things that are controlled by the other side. These are not there to reveal what's going on. They're there to conceal what's going on. Once in a while, you'll get something right there. They can't censor everything. But here, you know, in 3 hour, almost a 3 hour production, you are going to get tremendous insight into at least one of the secret societies, if certainly the secret society that was so instrumental in creating the background of America. And then, of course, as America turned from its Christian background towards the occult background, because there were always two forces in America. One was the Christian, one was the occult. The occult was always here. It was very powerful. It worked secretly behind the scenes, promoting itself into key positions. The Christians were there, trying, of course, to maintain a Christian society. But by the time FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had actually finished his term in office, the occultists, the Masons, were in total control. They controlled our Supreme Court. And from 1941 until 1971, during which years they took God and prayer out of our schools and began to centralize all power in Washington, D.C., the Masons were in total control of the United States Supreme Court, and they permeate every aspect of our society today. And so one of the things that Chris actually talks about are the ley lines. Would you like to talk a little bit about that, Chris? I thought that was so fascinating that the average individual has never actually grasped the fact that everything is laid out in astrological terms.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty fascinating too, Dr. Stan. We managed to get an interview with a guy named Jim Allison, who's a lawyer in Alabama. And he's got a website up on the internet where he talks about what he calls these great circles that encompass the earth. And upon these circles are all of the ancient monuments that are built. And he mentions things like Easter Island and the pyramids in Egypt and Stonehenge and a host of sites around the world, many of which I'd never even heard of before, but it's just amazing. And it so clearly supports, I believe, you know, the history of the world given by the Bible, how everybody was unified at Babel and then the cultures were scattered and by God. And then all of these incredible cultures sprang up around the world, and they had so many things in common. And one of them was this building technique that they had of building these towers or pyramids or places of worship that were built upon these lines or ley lines, as they're called, that are believed to be kinds of lines of power in the earth. And so they build things on these ley lines, thinking that they'll be empowered by the spirit realm and perhaps by the earth itself.
And, of course, that's really so much of the lore of the pyramid. There is secret power there, tapping into the dark side. Chris was just saying that, of course, the followers of Sir Francis Bacon came to America after Bacon's death, but certainly they came at the behest of Sir Francis Bacon and Sir Walter Raleigh and others who were all part of these secret societies. So pick up the story there, Chris.
Well, Bacon definitely sent these societies here, and we've got William Schneblin, who does a great job, I think, in his interview in the documentary. He talks about what he calls the first occult beachhead in America, which is the Ephrata Cloister. And it's in Ephrata, Pennsylvania. And it was initially a Rosicrucian commune, a Rosicrucian community that came to America with, you know, a similar dream to the Pilgrims. You know, the Pilgrims came over to spread Christianity and, you know, live and establish a Christian nation. But the Rosicrucians came for the purpose of establishing this secret society nation that they hoped would grow and develop and so on. And I was even reading an article after we finished the documentary or maybe it was just as we were finishing it anyway, but that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, Franklin, of course, who was both a Mason and a Rosicrucian, had visited the Ephrata Cloister at one point in their lifetime. And there's a lot of evidence that both Jefferson and Franklin were very much into the teachings of Sir Francis Bacon and greatly influenced by him. Jefferson, in particular, believed that Francis Bacon was one of the three most important men in history, And some believe, some claim that Jefferson viewed himself as fulfilling Bacon's dream for a new Atlantis by founding the United States of America. So, Bacon had a very compelling influence on men like Thomas Jefferson, men like Benjamin Franklin, of course, who most likely followed Bacon's ideas on the printing press and, you know, publishing literary works to influence people, which both of them did in their lifetimes. And Benjamin Franklin even published a book on ciphers and secret codes, which Bacon was a master of. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier, Dr. Stan, was how the intelligence community is embroiled or enmeshed with secret societies. And one of the things we talk about in this documentary is how the secret societies really founded the modern intelligence network, at least in the West, it would seem. And Bacon and his Rosicrucians were a part of that. According to Peter Dawkins, who spent more than 30 years researching these guys, he says that the Rosicrucians formed in England for the purpose of protecting Queen Elizabeth I after she came to the throne. And the Vatican wanted her killed, of course, because she was a Protestant. So all of these assassins came out to try and kill her. And there were other, Catholic empires and so on that were trying to overthrow her. And so the Rosicrucians formed this network around Queen Elizabeth. And a lot of these guys who were Rosicrucians, and they were a member of Bacon's Literary Society, were men like Ben Jonson, who was a poet, Christopher Marlowe, the famous playwright who wrote Dr. Faustus and so on, and there were a host of others. And these guys were writers, they were artists, and they were very much into the development of language, but they employed this initially in their intelligence work throughout Europe. And they were developing new words and so on so that they could communicate with each other in secrecy, and developing secret codes and whatnot that they were sending backwards and forwards. And, of course, the English intelligence network under Francis Walsingham during this era is legendary, to this day. And we see the secret societies hand in glove with the intelligence network, which is, I believe, a tradition that has continued from that time to the present day, because then you find the same thing happening, and we talk about this with Benjamin Franklin during the Revolutionary War, that Franklin, who was a Freemason and a Rosicrucian, and he was a member of, he was a Grand Master of a lodge in Philadelphia, Grand Master of the French Lodge there in Paris, and he was a member of the Hellfire Club in England. And, of course, America, England, and France were the three countries that were involved in the Revolutionary War. And there's evidence that Franklin had a communication system that was going throughout these three countries, and people working behind the scenes in each of them through the Masonic Lodge, through the Rosicrucian, most likely through the Rosicrucian Lodge, although I haven't found specific evidence to that effect, and most certainly through the Hellfire Club, for which there seems to be an abundance of evidence. And the Hellfire Club is something that a lot of people are unaware of, but they were a very clandestine, a very dark group of guys came out of this whole movement of gentlemen's clubs in England and Scotland during the 16th and 17th century. And Franklin joined up with these guys through a man named Sir Francis Dashwood, who was the founder of the Hellfire Club at a place called in West Wickham. And he called the group the Monks of Medmenham Abbey. And there's a very interesting link with Dashwood and a modern Mason and Rosicrucian named Aleister Crowley, which you and I know have studied in other work. The Hellfire Club donned the motto. In fact, over the Hellfire Cave was the motto, "Do what thou wilt."
Because that was Crowley's slogan, wasn't it?
Right. But Crowley most likely picked it up from, we know he picked it up from Francois Rabelais, the French priest who coined the phrase in his book Pantagruel, or his book Pantagruel, where he had this imaginary place that one of his characters built called the Abbey Thelema, and in the Abbey Thelema there was but one rule or law, and that was do what you will or do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And the Hellfire Club picked up on this, and that was their motto. And it was really just to follow the desires of your own will. And of course, this was the Thelema was Crowley's religion that he founded, his new religion, and he even started his own Abbey Thelema after Francois Rabelais' imaginary Thelema in Sicily. And, of course, that's where it's because of the bizarre occult rituals and so on that Crowley was into that he became known as the wickedest man in the world, according to the London newspapers in his time. But it's very, very likely, I think, that Crowley knew about Dashwood because they were both Englishmen. Crowley was very much like a modern Hellfire Club member. He was very wealthy. He had a lot of money, and he was English, and he loved to party. He was very much into the occult, and he was a rough character. And the Hellfire members were really rough characters as well. But they were, at the same time, they were very serious guys. As we point out, Dashwood was, you know, involved in the House of Lords and the House of Commons for more than 20 years.
Now, of course, I think one of the interesting things is the tie-in to the intelligence community. Certainly we know that Aleister Crowley, who was known affectionately by the people who knew him when he lived on a house on Loch Ness as the other Loch Ness Monster, but he was deeply involved with intelligence. And so many of these people have been involved with the intelligence agencies. And one of the most fascinating things was the tie-in between a man named James Bond, who, of course, was created a fictional character, and Dr. D. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? I thought that was a fascinating thing. I'd never heard of that before, but obviously the man who created the gentleman who created James Bond had formerly worked for British intelligence, and he knew about Dr. D and 007.
Yeah, in fact, Ian Fleming, very, very quickly, Ian Fleming, during World War II, he was a part of British intelligence. He had actually come up with the idea to employ Aleister Crowley for intelligence work in dealing with the Nazis. But his idea for James Bond came from Dr. John Dee, because Dee was known in the intelligence network as 007. And he was a very close advisor to Queen Elizabeth I. He was the Queen's astrologer. He had cast the astrological chart for when Queen Elizabeth would be coronated as Queen. And so he was very close in the court. He fared very well under Elizabeth. And he always signed his correspondence to the Queen, 007. And that's something we talk about in the documentary. And Ian Fleming picked up on that. And that it's from there that he developed the whole idea of James Bond, Agent 007, and so on.
And, of course, Dee, who we're talking, he must have been living, what, in the 1500s, early 1600s?
In the same time as Sir Francis Bacon, in the late 1500s, early 1600s. I'm trying to remember exactly when Dee passed away, but I don't know the exact year. But he preceded Francis Bacon by about 30 years.
Right.
But he definitely knew Bacon. He knew Bacon's family, and they were from the same era. There's at least one record of Bacon going to Dee's library at Mortlake, where Dee lived and so on. And there's a lot of evidence that Bacon was influenced by him.
And, of course, these people were all deeply involved in the occult. And when you understand that, so much of what's going on makes sense. There really are people who've gone over to the other side. And, of course, there's great reward there. There's great financial advantage. You can see this in the musicians who've given themselves over over to Lucifer. And you'll see them the sign there with the index and small finger outstretched and the thumb out to the side. But, of course, most people don't know that that is the sign of the devil. It's called The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning. And, of course, he's talking about these ideas of passing the lamp. And, of course, unless you understand that from the very inception of America, there have been occultists here who wanted to use America's power, America's, of course, a military to bring about this new world order. And right now, we are moving rapidly towards a war in the Middle East. And there are many people who think it'll just be a weak war. We'll just bomb Iran, and that'll be the end of the war. Well, there were a lot of people who, at the First World War, thought, this is just going to be a little war between Serbia and Austria-Hungary. It'll be over in a week or two, and that's what they all thought. And 20 million dead people later, and another 40 million wounded people later, why the war came to an end. But they didn't have nuclear weapons at that time, and what we're really looking about towards is a nuclear war in the Middle East, because if you think that the Iranians are going to sit back as we simply move in and bomb their nuclear production facilities, you don't have any idea. They do have nuclear weapons. Yosef Podansky's been writing about that for years. He's the in charge of research for the Republicans in the House of Representatives. The Pakistanis have nuclear weapons, and of course, if we attack Iran, there will probably be a revolution in Pakistan, and the radical Islamic people, the followers of Osama bin Laden, will seize control of Pakistan with all of their nuclear weapons. We are on the brink, on the very edge of cataclysmic changes. Now, is this going to happen in a few months? We don't know. Maybe it'll wait, as one of my guests says, until after the November elections. But then, of course, he's looking at it logically. And nothing, of course, that's going on today is logical. Go ahead and pick up the story there, Chris.
Well, you know, since we're talking about modern developments, one of the things that we try to do in Secret Mysteries is to show that this plan, which is an ancient plan that goes back thousands of years for the new Atlantean Empire, is really most likely the driving force behind what's happening with the Bush administration, with the war in Iraq. And, you know, we ask the question, you know, as America marches forward to spread democracy throughout the globe, which is exactly what President Bush is doing, and it's what he's promoting, that his way of solving the war on terror is not just to go and, you know, wipe out the terrorists or whatever, but it's to bring democracy to all of these terrorist nations, and that's supposedly going to solve the problem. Well, that solution that he's presenting, which, as you said, is not really indicative of America. We were founded as a republic, not a democracy. Many of the founding fathers believed democracy in its true form was a horrible form of government. And so we were founded as a republic, but President Bush is going around the world to spread world democracy. And so we pose the question in Secret Mysteries, is it just a coincidence that the war in Iraq has provided this opportunity to really carry out the ancient hope, as President Bush has called it, of the secret societies? And that is, that ancient hope is spelled out very clearly by Manly P. Hall in his writings as this worldwide democratic commonwealth of nations. And that's exactly what the Bush administration is promoting and pursuing. And that's what the war in Iraq is all about. It's what the war on terror is all about. And it provides the obvious vehicle for democracy to be spread. And I guess because most Americans and most people in the world don't understand, you know, what a pure democracy would be. And a pure democracy, if 51% of the people want something, you give it to them. You know, if 51% of the people want to legalize rape or, you know, child molestation or something, then that would become legalized in a true democracy. You wouldn't have any fixed laws. The laws would be subject to change based upon the whim of the people. And this was something that a number of the founding fathers spoke against. And it's not a form of government that, in my opinion, would really serve mankind ultimately.
And of course, we've seen what happens when you have a democracy, a democratic vote in Palestine. They, of course, voted in Hamas, dedicated to war with Israel.
Yeah.
If they had a free election in Egypt, why radical Islam would take over there tomorrow? If they had a free election in Turkey, why radical Islam would take over? The only reason they haven't is because they have a military dictatorship with a facade of democracy. Ladies and gentlemen, we're moving into terribly dangerous times, and the average American has no idea that behind all of this is the ancient plan of the mystery religions and the secret society.
Well, the supernatural side of it, interestingly enough, we were talking about. But one of the things I wanted to say along these lines, Bacon's supernatural contact that we chronicle and we show it there in the documentary is through his muse, his inspiration, Pallas Athena. And Pallas Athena was the Greek goddess who wore a great helmet, and whoever donned the helmet would become invisible. The helmet of Athena granted invisibility, which is kind of a symbol for secrecy. So Bacon had this group that he called the Knights of the Helmet. And the Knights of the Helmet is a reference to the helmet of Athena. And one of the things that Athena was known for was carrying a great spear, and she shook her spear, supposedly, at the Dragon of Ignorance. And the spear represented light or knowledge. In Masonry, light is knowledge. And so Baconians believe, and there's a lot of evidence to it, that this whole idea of the spear shaker was something that Bacon turned and he flipped it around, and he used it as the name Shakespeare. And so there are many writers, many researchers, including guys like Peter Dawkins certainly, and Manly P. Hall, who believe that Sir Francis Bacon is the real genius behind the Shakespeare plays. And the plays themselves were inspired initially, the impetus for them, came from the supernatural realm, from this vision that Bacon had, where this heavenly voice instructed him to hide his work secretly, to put aside popular applause, not look for the roar of the crowd himself, but to do his work in secret. And Bacon even writes about this in his own writings, writes about doing his work in secret like Solomon the king, and it's a reference to the proverb that says it is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. And so Bacon writes about that proverb and how in the imitation of God, even as God conceals his work, Bacon would conceal his own work behind the identity of Shakespeare. And so then we spend a pretty good bit of time talking about the whole Bacon-Shakespeare controversy, because as Manly Hall says in his book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, Bacon supposedly wrote into the Shakespeare plays the principles and teachings of Rosicrucianism and the true ceremonies, as Hall puts it, of the Freemasonic order. So he's incorporating the principles of the ancient mysteries and the secret societies into the writings of Shakespeare.
And, I think if you go back and you study Shakespeare, and I'm not a great a scholar of this, but, this was magnificent poetry. It was magnificent stories, and there were so many of them. They're one of the most prolific writers of all time. And the question is, did William Shakespeare, who was barely literate, really do this? He could barely write his name, And of course, you actually go to the home of William Shakespeare there and talk to the man who heads that museum, who is very, very defensive of William Shakespeare, tries to sort of say, well, of course he wrote, of course everybody knows he wrote it, but you almost had a feeling he was a little defensive, wasn't he?
Oh, he certainly was. He and Peter Dawkins both really, really nice men. They both were, and they're both on opposing sides of this debate. But we present both of their arguments, and I don't know. I became really persuaded after talking to him and really examining his interview. I really do believe that that Bacon and his literary group were behind the plays. But some of his defenses of the Stratford actor, as he's called, William Shakespeare, as some people refer to him, kind of reveal that there's more to the story. I mean, to me, the thing that, and we really unfolded in the documentary, and we let the guys who have studied this for years talk about the evidence, and we point out some of the secret clues that are there, so I don't want to give them all away.
Well, we don't want to, because people will want to see the DVD, and even more than that, why, of course, when you get into it, get towards the end, you want to see more, and of course, it ends at almost 3 hours, but you can hardly wait for the next part to come about. And of course, that's going to be the cast in stone, cut in stone.
Riddles in Stone. We're gonna do a documentary on the secret architecture of Washington D.C. That's going to be volume 2.
And of course, Washington D.C. is laid out in Masonic form. It's covered in the book, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, put up by HarperCollins. Everything in Washington, D.C. is Masonic. Masonic symbols, astrological symbols, this is well known, except, of course, to the average American, who has no idea what this is really all about. That is, as I considered what you were telling me about, Shakespeare write Shakespeare, or did St. Francis Bacon with his group write Shakespeare? And then, of course, I had the other alternative in my mind, and that was, was this all channeled as Sir Francis Bacon by a demonic spirit? And, of course, if you go into the background to the writings of Alice Bailey and Barbara Marx Hubbard and Helena Petrovna Blavatsky and even many of our great writers of modern times, Taylor Caldwell, so many of her great books, even books that had a strong Christian background, and yet she herself was not a Christian, and she never knew where the stories came from. She actually, there's a book written, In Search of Her Soul, or In Search of Her Meaning, written by a man who, as she went to seances to find out where she got the ideas for the wonderful stories she wrote. And I couldn't help but wonder if perhaps much of this was channeled through Sir Francis Bacon, then, of course, to begin to mold and change British society. And Shakespeare has had such a profound impact on British and certainly on American society. Have you ever considered that maybe this was all channeled?
Well, it certainly would fit in with the model that's there. I mean, it's from channeling a spirit that Bacon was inspired to write theatrical works, and he was writing them with his literary group, many of whom were members of the Rosicrucian society. And the Rosicrucians believed in tapping into the spirit realm to gain knowledge and understanding and wisdom and so on. So I think what you're saying, Dr. Stan, is not only very likely, I think that's that's exactly how it came about. I think that has to do with the great brilliance of the plays and the writings themselves, that there's, there's a tremendous amount of knowledge in the plays, a lot of information, and just brilliance about the human condition. And interwoven, as we pointed out, it really represents Rosicrucianism as a whole, because it incorporates the teachings of Christianity with the teachings of paganism and the esoteric mysteries, and they're all intertwined together. You've got Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet right alongside Midsummer Night's Dream and Macbeth, and you've got all of these occult elements that are interwoven in the plays, and with them are certain biblical principles, and this can be very confusing, I think, to those who study the plays. There's even a book written by Dr. I.D.E. Thomas called Man of the Millennium, William Shakespeare and His Bible. And he's of course writing from the perspective that Shakespeare was probably a Bible believing Christian man. And it can seem that way if you just focus on the biblical verses in the plays. But to do that, you're going to ignore now all of the esoteric and occult elements and philosophies and so on that are interwoven with those teachings. And that's really a picture to me of what America has become. It has become this intertwining. So you've got our president, who many people believe is a fundamental Bible-believing evangelical Christian man, and yet he's going to mosques and he's saying that Allah is the same as the God of the Bible. He's recorded worshiping at a Shinto Buddhist shrine, you know, and he's saying things like there are many paths to God and so on, all the while that he's claiming to be a devout Christian.
And of course, he is leading the world into a nuclear holocaust, and whether he knows it or not, this is the direction we're headed today, as plans are already been taken for the bombing of Iran. And, of course, Syria will be right along with that. And then, like an incendiary device, the whole of the Islamic world will light up. Well, let's go to Ted, who's calling us from Georgia. I'd appreciate if other people did not call in, but as long as Ted is here. Ted, do you have a question for our guest?
Well, yes, I have a question. Is the Federalist Movement, the Federalist Society included in the book?
No, this is not. Has nothing to do with the Federalist Society.
Why doesn't it? I don't understand. The Federalist Society is very much part of the English movement in reaction to the Revolutionary War.
Do you have any comment on that, Chris?
You know what? I've heard of the Federalist Society. I'm not entirely certain when they came about, but I honestly did not stumble across them when I was researching Francis Bacon. Is there a direct correlation to Bacon?
I don't know that there's a direct correlation to Bacon, except that the English is part of the English movement, in my opinion.
All right, fine. Well, of course, this is really about the secret society that Francis Bacon created along about the same time that why the first settlers were coming to America. But thanks so much, Ted. And let's get back, of course, to this whole idea of the esoteric organizations, because certainly you can look at the Templars and the Rosicrucians, and if you go into the background of Masonry and you see the various degrees they take, there's one that is the Knights Templar, another one that, of course, is the Rosicrucian. So embedded within modern-day Masonry, at least the Scottish Rite branch, are these other ancient secret societies. And this ties into Gnosticism, it ties into the Kabbalah, it ties into so many different esoteric organizations and movements that have been around down through the ages. Would you agree with that?
Oh, certainly. I mean, this whole thing is, it really does go back, you know, as far back as man's history goes. It goes back to you could trace it all the way back to the Garden of Eden, the temptation of the serpent to man with the tree of knowledge is entirely what Bacon represents, because it was through knowledge or science that Bacon believed mankind could achieve his own salvation. And Peter Dawkins, who's the real Baconian expert, and he writes books on this stuff, he talks about the Rosicrucian and Freemasonic 6 days work, which, you know, Bacon believed in the 6 days work of creation, that, you know, just like God created the earth, the heavens and the earth and all that is in them in 6 days, he believed that it was man's responsibility since his fall in the Garden of Eden to recreate paradise on earth, okay? And he would do it through knowledge and experience and by building his own paradise on earth. And then man would really be in a perfect state because he would have earned his paradise by his own hard labor. Okay? And, of course, if you're a Christian and you believe the teachings of the Bible and you believe that we're not saved by our works but by God's grace through faith in Jesus Christ, this movement, as good as it sounds to the human condition, it doesn't seem from what I've studied of Bacon that he had some sort of sinister motivation. He seemed to have had a very, you know, humanistic and, you know, true desire to help humanity. But it's his method of helping humanity is the antithesis of the gospel message. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh. I think it certainly does. And, of course, with so many religions, it's how we are going to bring the kingdom of heaven to earth. And of course, the radical Muslim believes that if they can create a world chaos, they're going to be able to bring the Mahdi back. And the Jew waits for the Messiah. And of course, the Hindu waits for the return of the Maitreya. The Christian waits for the coming of, second coming of Jesus Christ. But the question is, they certainly, all the others are waiting, I believe, for the man of sin that's described in Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians. And there is to come a world ruler, a demonic ruler, I believe, part of the unholy Trinity. It just as there's a Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, so there is the Antichrist, there is the false prophet, and there is Satan himself in the unholy Trinity. And I really think that we're seeing unfolding before us truly prophetic things that are going to happen that will change the world we live in forever.
Yeah, well, it's certainly, Bacon, I think, and this new Atlantean concept, I believe, really fits into Bible prophecy. In fact, one of the titles that Bacon gave himself was the Herald of the New Age. And as Peter Dawkins says in the documentary, you know, that he was, that the Herald of the New Age, that's the title given to Elijah, who comes to herald the coming of the Christ. So Bacon is seen by Baconians as this kind of herald for the coming Christ figure. Of course, you know, we ask the question in the documentary rather carefully, is this the Christ of the Bible, or is this the Christ of Masonry, some other Christ? And we know as Christians that the Greek prefix anti has two meanings. It means against, but it also means another. So another Christ is literally Antichrist. And if you study the New Age movement, that's very much what it seems at this time that the Antichrist figure will be, another Messiah. He won't necessarily look like a Saddam Hussein character, you know, with a shotgun off the balcony or something. He will probably be a very appealing, enlightened person who people will gravitate toward. The Bible says that all the world will worship him, whose names are not found written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So it would certainly seem that Bacon's idea for creating the perfect society and Bacon's idea of what the Christ figure might be would certainly fit into that.
And of course, the thing is, people are not going to want to give up their sovereignty, their freedom, until some terribly cataclysmic event happens. Could we be facing just such an event at these times? What a wonderful time it is to have a personal relationship with our Lord.